Hello! Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Hey!
Who just told me my audio sucks.
Yep.
Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Who did not defend me when Guillaume told me my audio sucks.
He's got nothing to do with it anymore.
He doesn't and have Mr. to John worry Lindemann, about
you. Your audio and your content sucks, James.
Who just needs a defense attorney, probably. And this is February 25th, 2016, and this will be episode 465 of Radio Free Nintendo.
Man, you got that right. Amazing. It's progress.
All right, John. All right, John. I've got it written down in front of me. Thank you.
Oh, there you go.
I survived a tornado, John. I don't need this from you.
Well, at least your power's on.
That's true. My
so
power's
you could be
back.
Here for this amazing shtick.
Great. So what a start to the show, John. Hey, everybody. You got 2 hours and you don't care about losing them? Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is why you don't get the host, John. We've got a... Oh, what was that?
No,
you
I got it. No, it's good. It's good. Continue.
You good
continue.
Over there? You have some one-liners for me.
I'm awesome. Good.
Anyway. We got a lot of games to talk about this week, but I'm going to lead off with the big game. Well, I guess now there's two because Pokemon came out today. The originals. But Nintendo's big 3DS... money-making machine, Fire Emblem Fates, which came out the day after we recorded last week. So this is the first time we're going to talk about it. So I bought Birthright, right? Hmm. Birthright, the easy one.
Right. So you went with Birthright instead of the
yes.
hardcore Conquest.
And there's a reason for this.
I thought I knew you.
Here's the reason. I'm going to play all three.
Okay.
And I figured if I started with Conquest and then went back to Birthright, I'd be miserable. So I went with Birthright and said, I'll just work from there. And
sure.
So first things first, much like when we discussed Awakening, I do play in casual mode, not because I can't deal with the instant or the permadeath. You know, I've beaten a bunch of Fire Emblem games. I just don't want to.
Sure.
So I play it like I'm trying not to let anybody die. So I don't do the like, well, fuck it. I'll just give him the next battle. Who cares? But I also don't have to restart when I make a really dumb mistake. Usually I just punish myself by saying, all right, that person's out for next battle, which is really shitty when it's like your best character, which happened in the last battle. So I've been fighting this current one without my best character who's perfectly suited for this battle because I'm punishing myself. Thanks, game. Thanks, me. Actually, this game adds another mode beyond casual, which I think it's called Phoenix mode, which is insane. Character dies, they come back like 2 turns later. It's basically you cannot lose mode, which is a little sad. Like, I don't much care for this mode's even existence, but whatever, if you want to play the game that way, that's your business. So, Birthright and Conquest. Those are the two main SKUs for this incredibly successful selling Fire Emblem game.
That's nuts.
And, yeah, crazy sales. So, Birthright is easy, and I'll say that right now. I set it up, there's the standard difficulty, normal, is actually not. It's for first timer. So when you're playing the game, don't start the game on normal. I threw my entire game away on that one because it got to the point where enemies were singularly choosing to go encounter the one unit I had that they were weakest against. And then impaling themselves on these weapons. And it would be like, I had a 30% chance to hit and they had a 99. They would miss and I would critical. It's like, alright game.
So it's Fire Emblem Babies pretty much.
It's beyond Fire Emblem Babies. It's almost an auto player. If you put this with the Phoenix mode, it might be the easiest game in existence. I'm not kidding. I had a situation where I was 30-70 on the odds of hitting. He missed and I criticaled. And that was against a boss. I was like, no, I can't deal with this. Like, I knew I made a mistake, but I'm like, alright, I'll just push through it. I'm gonna play the game again later with harder settings, whatever, I'll just push through. And I was so miserable that I just had to upped it all the way to the hard. And just said, I'll just deal with this. But it's still not very hard. So I guess even though there's a ton of Fire Emblem games, it's until very recently a niche series. So, you know, maybe I'll give a primer what Fire Emblem is. It's a turn-based strategy game where you have a band of soldiers that you pick up throughout the game and you develop, you give them new equipment, you change their class, they level up, etc. And each class and each weapon type has advantages and disadvantages. So you're basically trying to game this weapons triangle against your opponents. They changed up some of the items in this game, So the weapons triangle is a little bit different. Not hugely different, but just kind of figure out where I'm at on this stuff. But basically what you're doing is you've got a map and an objective, and it's the map's usually completely chock full of enemies, and your job is to either wipe them all out, which has been way too many of the missions in Birthright have been kill them all. Or just get somewhere or capture something or beat one boss, something like that. So you move your units in different classes, can move different distances, and you basically are trying to avoid putting them in position to get ambushed by enemies. And because all the enemies in this game on their turn act very programmatically, you know, they will take the softest target in their range every time. You can sort of set it up so, well, except in the easy mode, you will set it up so basically your entire objective is to drive enemies towards doom. So a lot of the game is sort of, you know, basic tactic stuff. You present a target for your enemy that you say, like, I want you to fight this guy because you are going to get screwed when you deal with him. And this is your only choice, and you just game the AI. You just say, like, come and get it. Have fun. Let's go. The only time the game really puts pressure on you, at least in Birthright, is usually at the very start of the mission when you're just completely surrounded and you're having to sort of deal with that momentary situation of there's no safe zones and you're having to create them quickly. But I mean, basically, this game, if you played Awakening, you're gonna basically feel like this game is just Awakening 2, which, I mean, I guess it is, in a way. It's good. I mean, I'm only about 12 chapters in, so it's hard for me to really say, you know, is it better than Awakening? Is it worse than Awakening? Is it about the same? I don't know yet.
The only thing you can say is that, it has more feet than Awakening.
It's true. It's got more, a lot of things than Awakening. It's got way more, it's got way more extreme close-ups of your party members than Awakening as they speak to you, which is more unnerving. So we made jokes about the face touching thing, which isn't in there, but they still have it is in there to a certain extent, but they still have the, you know, when you bring them up to your treehouse, which, yeah, it is a treehouse. I wasn't 100% sure if that was a joke or not, but it's literal ass treehouse. You bring them up there and you talk to them, and they do like that extreme close up of their face, and that's a little unsettling because it actually does like move their face as they talk, like it binds to the words they're saying. It's a little weird, and they don't say anything, and a lot of times they seem to be alluding to you guys having done something before the scene started. Like they walk in and the first thing they say, "Wow, that was great! I had a good time," and you're like, "What the fuck happened here?" So. Yeah, like the building your base is kind of, it is what it is. I would rather we just had a shop and I didn't have to build the individual shops and then walk to them to buy stuff. You know, just having it as a menu option of, I want to buy items, please. It's, to me, would be easier, but it's not a big deal. It just seems like it was something they added so they could have an extra feature set built into it. There are some missions where you defend your fort. They're not base missions. They're like submissions or missions you get for, you know, like, just to grind against. And basically you're just defending the throne of your mind awesome fortress, and you essentially just fight enemies and dudes. I mean, here's the thing, it's Fire Emblem. And when Awakening came out and nobody had played Fire Emblem but me, it was a lot easier to talk about Fire Emblem. But right now, everybody's played Fire Emblem because this game
anyway,
is...
Anyway, we did a retroactive on Sacred Stones before Awakening came
we
out.
We did.
Come on.
We did, yeah. So for this group, we had actually played... I'm trying to remember... Wait, was it Sacred Stones? I guess it was Sacred Stones.
It was, because that was the one that got ambassadored.
Oh, that's right.
We went with that one. Because like, at the time, obviously, like, GBA, the first GBA Fire Emblem, which was the first Fire Emblem full stop that came to the West, was difficult to get as a physical copy and wasn't ambassador or wasn't virtual console or anything at that point. So yeah, that was the sort of the appeal of it, really, was kind of getting to do a Fire Emblem retroactive, because a lot of them, like the even the GameCube and Wii games, were quite difficult
especially
to find. And,
yeah, Wii games.
Yeah, so you know, it's one of these, it was a cool opportunity to do it, and that was the first time I'd played Fire Emblem. And then since then I've gone on to play the first GBA one on Virtual Console and Awakening. But I guess I'm trying to make the best of the fact that this isn't going to be coming out in Europe for a while yet, because we don't even have a date, by the fact that it gives me more time to hear things like your impressions and stuff and make my mind up which one I'm going to buy, because I'm not as confident as you are that I would want to play all three.
Sure.
You know,
I would say in that case, well, how did you feel coming out of Awakening?
I'm really torn about it because on the one hand I've played three Fire Emblem games through at this point. That's quite a lot, you know.
The majority of them.
I'm not inexperienced with the series, but on the other hand, I didn't exactly like completely master them and do them on higher difficulties or all that kind of stuff. So I'm a little torn, but the main thing that's currently making me lean towards Conquest is some of what you've heard about the map design in terms of like kind of, you've touched on it a little bit with Birthright, in terms of just like a lot of missions are quite straightforward, like just killing stuff or whatever.
Kill whereas everything.
Conquest apparently has more wrinkles. That sounds more interesting to me. And I don't really mind the idea that you can't have sort of additional battles made to order to grind up your characters, because I never really indulged in that anyway.
The way
I played the other games that did have that in.
I will say I've made aggressive use of it, in part because depending on your difficulty, you have to pay to find these bands of brigands to hunt down. And I've made use of it just to get new characters sort of up and running. But anybody who's even remotely up to the par for where you are in the chapter currently is not going to get any experience out of those missions, or very little experience. So, you know, you get Mosu, who is the Donald of this game. Almost to the point where they probably should have not picked a village bumpkin with a spear, wearing ratty clothes, like, you know, maybe a little too on the nose. But I had to get her going because I looked at, you know, there's those bonuses that characters have, like the special abilities. And she had like three all driven towards, think about Fire Emblem, when they level up, the stat boost they get leveling up, it's influenced by what class they are, but how much they get is random. So there's 7 or 8 stats and they may get +1 in between 1 and 7 of those stats. Well, she's got a bunch that are geared towards basically making sure that when the dice rolls, the dice are loaded, so she gets a lot of stat boosts. So, I mean, I was basically just playing these training missions with the singular focus of leveling her up. I do think that maybe the affinity building could be difficult without the extra missions, because one of the things that I found in this game is the maps are quite big in general, and usually you're not going in with more than 10 characters, so essentially, what you're normally trying to do is, in most missions, the enemy are coming after you in the initial round of the fight. And then usually when you reach some sort of geographic point on the map, a second wave sort of starts to drop on you. But between then and the first wave is mostly just you approaching enemies who have sort of positioned themselves at choke points. And you kind of have to dislodge them, or you have to, like I said, offer them some kind of bait they can't refuse, and then, you know, walk them into their doom. So a lot of, in the early round, there's a lot of chaos going on, and you're just trying to, you know, bring order to the battlefield. And then it's a lot of just sort of moving through space. But if the objective is to kill everyone, that means you can't just bypass big blocks of the enemy. Now, nominally, you probably could. You could just go around them. And I've had missions where I went around them thinking, I just have to kill the boss, right? And then I get to the end and look back at the mission objective and go, son of a bitch. I have to go walk all the way back to these enemies I just completely ignored. But that means a lot of time you're spreading your forces relatively thin. Now, you're trying to do it in such a way that you maintain advantages on individual encounters. That's really all Fire Emblem is. Maintain an advantage through each encounter and don't get surprised by the enemy where they get the advantage. So I spend a lot of time just spreading my units out and trying to maintain that edge. And that means oftentimes you're kind of stuck dealing with just like enemy, your units are too spread out and they're not able to sort of build up that affinity.
You're not dealing with pairs of units moving together, which is going to be the best for, you know, them like protecting each other and building up the affinity.
Or you're dealing with a situation where you're pairing them up in a way to deal with that very specific scenario, not to sort of like, okay, I need these two to spend more time together. Like, if I want my two samurai to spend time together, I basically have to contrive situations for it, because there's no scenario where stacking two swordsmen is a good idea. Because essentially,
sure, yeah. You essentially know, you it's the same matchup, you know, so right. you haven't covered another contingency.
The only time it works is if you're looking out on the field, you're like, damn, they brought a lot of axes. They're about to have a real bad time. And then you just sort of stack them next to each other in a wall and let people behind them do business. But essentially, there's just a lot of just managing these individual conflicts and understanding what, when you know, when you move, what's going to come up as a result of your movement. It's a little bit like playing chess, because you don't want to just go like, okay, I can beat that guy right now. You really need to start thinking about, okay, if I move that unit there, what's going to be the response from the enemy? Like, how are they going to address the fact that I just dropped this thing right there? And there, like, I had a mission where I basically just threw shit at the problem. And, like, I knew this is a bad scene that I'm creating, and I need to either just get out or go. And I just went for it and said, all right, well, whatever happens, happens. And it was a disaster. Like, it was a bad scene all around. And there was no reason for it. Like, I just got reckless and just said, what's worse that could happen? And the answer was, take it on the chin. So even this relatively easier game, if you're not careful, if you don't think about what you're doing, if you're not studying the map, and, you know, the game will tell you how far all the enemies can go and what type of weapons they're using and how strong they are. It'll tell you everything there is to know about these enemies. If you're not careful, if you don't take your time and make sure you're not putting yourself in a bad place, even this relatively easier game can cost you. So it's really just a trial and awareness.
And then it forces you to sit there and watch as all the dominoes fall before you.
Right. Or, I mean, you can skip it, but you probably shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes it's not even a matter of like, oh, on the next turn, if I kill this guy, they won't have anybody who can hit me. Because you might need to look ahead and go, oh, but there's a guy riding on a river and right behind, like,
yep.
He can't get me this turn, but I'm sure as shit not outrunning him next turn. So what do I do? Do I put this guy here and try to bring up, say, an archer who can just shoot that guy out of the sky? Do I have somebody in position for that? You know, do I need to take a couple turns and rearrange my forces so I've got the people where I need them? It's, you know, if you play this game like I do, which is almost like playing it like a puzzle game, because in a lot of ways, a lot of the same, you know, parts of the brain are going. Like, mm-hmm. You're thinking about cause and effect, you're thinking about positioning, you're thinking about like, okay, if I rotate this way and I move them up here, what happens next? How do I... Or you'll see a scenario like there's a mission where there's a bridge and it's a general who can hit you with a lance from pretty much everywhere, backed up by a wizard who can hit you also from pretty much everywhere. So like, okay, well, how do I deal with that crap?
Does the enemy tend to do the same thing if you do the same thing?
Yeah, they're an algorithm. So yeah. if they will respond to identical situations the same way.
Yeah.
Now, the difficulties will affect that. So, like I said, when I was playing on easy, it seemed like they willingly threw themselves against the thing that they were most vulnerable to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, playing on the harder difficulties, they will go after what is most advantageous to them. But they will always go after something if they have a choice.
Yep.
Which, again, is kind of a chess concept, or I guess it's more of a checkers concept in that way. Like, you have to take an enemy, even if it's going to be a disaster for you, because mm-hmm. the rules necessitate you do it. So, like, you can, that's sort of what you do, though. I spend a lot of time setting them up to walk into disasters, knowing they can't help themselves. Like, I'm going to do this, even though this is a really bad idea. And that's just kind of how I just enjoy playing. I mean, speaking of the game, more specifically this game, Greg touched on the stuff that's different about it. This, you know, as a story conceit, the thing about Fire Emblem Awakening is they animate the shit out of it. Like, they turn the anime dial all the way to the extreme end. And that's a big reason why the game was probably a hit, even in Japan, relative to what the series has been. Like, in Japan, where that series has probably done better than it has here, that Awakening blew the doors off. Well, they found new settings on the anime dial for this game. Like, they added a couple notches. I don't know. This is some anime ass anime in this game, to the point of like characters walking around in just the most ridiculous outfits and saying the most insane things and doing the most illogical nonsense. And I love it. I love just how crazy and dumb it is about 30% of the time. So I'm digging it. Like, I'm digging this game. I'm still getting in there. There's some weirdness, and I think picking Birthright is sort of my own fault. You know, I sort of created the situation for myself. But, you know, I understand that if I had gone to Conquest, I would probably not have been able to go back to Birthright.
I get that. I kind of said, and that's another thing that makes me kind of feel like I might just go straight to Conquest when it gets here, maybe. Like I said, yeah. I kind of like that puzzle game kind of way of looking at it. And I kind of feel like grinding on the outside kind of is like colouring outside the lines. You know, it's like kind of a way to over, to beat it with brute force rather than strategy. So
absolutely.
The only sort of anxiety I've got about that is, am I actually good enough to do it that way?
Here's the thing: Birthright still has, Conquest still has the casual mode. It's still got difficulty.
Yeah, you've still got settings you could dial down, other settings, but you know, it's not quite the same, is it? You know,
right.
If I was going to go with anything, I'd probably go with the complexity of the maps. But one thing I was going to say, story wise, like obviously you've sort of thinking about playing all three, but when you got to the, the sort of branching point in the story, did you have a feeling of like, if I had to make one choice, which one would you have chosen based on the story now?
Absolutely. So this game is from Japan, and guess what? The Japanese-style kingdom is, like, overwhelmingly kind of good dudes, and then the Western-style kingdoms are sadist fuckers. Like, it's like, there's no question who you... Like, you look at them, you're like, she's walking around in a bustier armor and just straight up talking about, like, when she cared for her brother as a baby, but also this sounds weirdly sexual and unpleasant. I don't want anything to do with this. Also, she just killed a dude while she was talking to me like that. I don't... What? No, I don't want this. Like, the idea being, of course, that you are a prince of this one kingdom who somehow ended up in the hands of their rival kingdom as a very young child and was raised as one of their children. And at some point is given the opportunity to choose between staying with the family that raised him or returning to the family he was born from. And sort of the tension that arises from that. And of course, that's where the anime comes in. That's where the anime-ass anime really kicks it up to 11, because you've got like sisters making passes at you and just weird shit all around and just creepiness in general. But yeah, like if you had to pick to hang out with Nor or Hoshido, only sadists would say, I want to hang out with the Norians. They sound like they're good people. They kill people for shits and giggles. Yeah, let's do that. So I'm not knowing anything about that branch of the story, I would assume they can't just make you a bad dude, because like it's like there's very cut and dry, like these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. I would assume you're gonna have to do some kind of nonsense, like burn it down from inside or something, just burn it all down. But you know, I'm actually kind of interested in how they're gonna handle the third path stuff. I know some people already have it in their hands if you bought the incredibly impossible to get special edition, but I'll be curious how they sort of round the corner on, all right, you decide I don't want to be with either of these people. Like, how do you handle that? How do they approach the idea that you've picked none of the above and now you have to fight a war? So I'm interested to see how they handle the idea that this story can be told three different ways. You know, that means there's a lot of characters to meet, and some of the characters in this game are complete. I'm trying to think of a good word for it. Human mistakes might be the best way to describe them. And some of them are people you would never want to associate with, and I just can't get over how awesome it is to just meet somebody who's just a complete failure of a human being and then have them come up to your room and tell you how great that was when they first walk in the door. Like something happened that you didn't get to know about. Also, they're blushing and look winded. Thanks, Fire Emblem. Thank you. And, I mean, granted, I'm going to be playing a lot more of this game and the other versions of this game, so this will come up some more, but Guillaume.
So I've been playing through my Steam games that I got the last Christmas sale, and that's still going on. And so with Karen again, I've been playing her story. So I'm kind of in a kick of games that try to tell stories in kind of new ways. Not that last week's Life is Strange was really a new way to tell a story, but you know what I mean.
Story-driven experiences.
Yeah. And her story is kind of this interesting concept. The tagline in the trailer is like a game about a woman talking to the police. So, I don't know. That's pretty much what it is. You start the game and you get this interface, like kind of Windows 95 kind of interface. And you've got this program open with video sequences, and you've got a couple, you can see the desktop, you can see a couple of readmes telling you, basically, if you open them, they tell you how to use the software, so basically how to play the game. And so you watch the videos that you have lined up for you, and without really more context, you know. And yes, like it's just this woman being filmed giving a testimony, like talking to the cops. And you don't even know her name. And basically what you're trying to do is to pay attention and kind of like listen to what she's saying. And then use terms that you think are significant and type them down in the software that you're using so that you can bring up more videos that you can watch and repeat until like you basically have the full story. So
there's no win condition in this game, right?
There's no win condition. Like you can basically stop at any time, like when you feel like you've got, like you can try to find all the videos. You've got some sort of defrag looking graphic thing, like this tool that shows you where in the timeline this video is set, and you know which pieces of video you haven't found and which ones you've found. So you can aim for 100% completion, and we've done that, but we've cheated towards the end because it really wasn't fun. And my recommendation would be stop when you feel like you've got everything, because you probably have. The rest of the small videos are probably like 3 words long and were really, you know, like they're not important. But so anyway, yes.
So when you search for stuff, I mean, I've only ever seen video of this game, so... Mm-hmm. When you search for stuff in the whole search prompt, what sort of triggers a clip coming up? Like, is it just a word that's said in the interview? Is it a topic that the interview covers? Like, what determines if this is going to be a valid word to find a given clip?
Right. Well, all the clips have subtitles, right? Like, someone, I guess the in the game's fictional world, someone went through all the videos and typed down what she was saying, and so I guess that's what you're looking for.
I see.
So that leads to a few kind of quote-unquote puzzles that are kind of iffy to me. Like, sometimes there are certain words that you can look for that should yield certain results, but they're not going to pop up because that word would have been, like, in brackets, because for whatever reason, like, I don't want to spoil too much, but anyway, it's kind of a stupid thing, and it's one of the things that I looked up.
Like an implied word as opposed to the word that she actually said, you say in brackets?
Like, she's answering a question very formally, and so they put it in quotation marks.
Oh, okay, I see.
Right. So, but she's always answering questions. Everything should be in quotation marks. Like, I don't think it really makes sense. But again, like, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Sorry.
The videos, like, you're going to be basically, like, you do start with a few videos and you learn from there, I think, basically, that there's a guy named Simon and something bad happened to him. And that's why she's there. She's being interrogated. And so one of the first things you're going to do is type Simon again. And then you're going to get more results. Like, of course, his name pops up, like, I don't know, like 45 times, but the game only ever shows you the first 5 results and doesn't give you a way to scroll to the next, 43. So, you have to find ways. Like, the challenge really is sometimes, you know, to narrow your search or to find other words and to try to get all the story by typing down the correct words. But while you're doing that, you're also trying to keep the story straight in your head, which is not as easy as it seems, because she was interrogated like 7 or 8 different times. So you got to be careful. You do see kind of the date on the videos, and you can, you know, like, you can pay attention to that. You can also pay attention to what she's wearing, because she's wearing different stuff. So, you know, that might help you keep track very easily, you know, just looking at it. Okay, so this testimony is from that day. But eventually you realize, like, you know, like, you might learn a fact, and you're like, okay, so, like, if you want, you can note down in an actual, like, notepad or whatever, like, okay, so her name is this, and I can move on, I've got this info. And then, whoa, like, something comes up without really much context, and it completely throws your understanding of what was going on upside down. And I just love this aspect of it. Like, that's what makes the whole game interesting, really. You're being fed the story, but it's absolutely non-linear. And you have to put it together in your head, but you also, like, no two person is going to have the same experience, because no one is going to, you know, enter these words at the exact same, in the exact same order. No one is going to get the story exactly the same way. So, you know, you might be very early in the story and see this facet of what happened, and I might be very early in the story in the game and see this completely different thing. And the more that you see videos, the more you learn about what actually happened. And it just, like, the story evolves that way, you know? It's not just that you're being fed more story, but your understanding of it shifts. So, I don't know, it's really, really well done. The scenario is not quite as bonkers as something in a Phoenix Wright game, but it is, you know, it's pretty out there. And, you know, while being, I don't want to say realistic, but it's not like there's no, like, talking parrot, like, it's not Ace Attorney. It's kind of supposed to be grounded in reality. But at the same time, the scenarios, yeah, it's pretty out there. And there are a few things that you have to suspend your disbelief about. You know, like, I don't really know. I don't know how actual police interrogations work. All I know is from TV. And this game is set in the UK, not the US. But, like, I've never seen Luther hand a suspect a guitar and ask them to play a folk song. So that's, you know... That's a little bit. That's a little bit
weird. That's how I interrogate
John. Mm-hmm. but overall, like, it's really well written. The actress Viva Seffert is really, really good. I've looked up online. It seems to be her only acting credit. Like, she's a singer, former gymnast. Like, I don't know. Like, it comes out of nowhere, but she has to find a really fine line, and I think she does a really good job considering what she had. To do what she had to, what character she had to play. And you know, even once you decide that you're done, that you've got all the story, that you've seen enough videos and that you think, you know, like you've put together her testimony in your head. You still have to decide, like, okay, do I believe this or not? You know, and you don't get, you know, of course, apparently in the premise, like the videos have been jumbled because of Y2K. Like, this is an old case, and the videos of the side of the police are gone. So you never get the questions that were asked. So there's a lot of missing holes, even when you do, you know, get the full picture. So it's really good. It's really interesting. And we really enjoyed it.
Guillaume, just as a computer scientist, ruined the entire game for me now. I can't even play it. I'm just upset.
Just
upset forever. Y2K is the worst excuse for anything ever.
Well, I think it's tongue-in-cheek. It's like, it's
Yeah, I would assume so.
Yeah.
I don't remember British law enforcement coming to some sort of cataclysm around about them. They lost all the records.
All the videos have only lost half of them. I don't know what happens. Also, they're out of order. Fuck it. Who cares?
Yeah. But no, it's cool. I really enjoyed it. And it's like, I don't know, like $6 Canadian, probably $5 US on Steam. It's not an expensive date. So I don't know. I recommend it. It was really, really good. And another game that I played, also story heavy, this time on Nintendo system. I've been playing Virtue's Last Reward.
Oh.
And I had been, I don't know, I didn't really want to play this game. I played 999 back on the DS, and I had, you know, I enjoyed it, kind of, but there was a lot of stuff about it that bugged me.
Yeah.
And, you know, this game was finally on sale in the eShop 2-3 weeks ago, so that's when I picked it up. I was like, okay, fine, I'll give it a chance. And basically, everything that bugged me about 999 is back here, and I kind of regret it. You know, I've had this in my bag, like on my commute. I've had this my 3DS and my e-reader at all times, and I don't know why I started a copy of Crime and Punishment that I got for free on my e-reader, Wow. And I'm now 200 pages into Crime and Punishment, and I'm maybe an hour into Virtue's Last Reward. So I don't know what that says. Here's I'm not enjoying Crime and Punishment.
No.
I'm just...
No,
Crime and Punishment is doing the work when you read that book.
It really is. It's really, it's dense.
Here's what I would say. Virtue's Last Reward. The thing about that game is it is basically a distilled version of 999. So if you really like 999, it's everything you like about that game, like, just wrapped down. But if there's anything about 999 that gets on your nerves, that just irks you, it's magnified.
Well, the thing
everything about that game is just more.
Right. Well, I liked the scenario of 999 enough. And of course, I didn't really dig the multiple playthroughs that didn't really tell you if you were making progress or not. You know, like you could get into a path that led you to the same ending that you had gotten before and not make any progress that way. So I think they fixed that in this, but I'm not even that far. Like I haven't finished one playthrough. What bugs me is mechanical gameplay stuff. Because this game, you know, like I like reading. I like kind of reading diagonally sometimes. Like I like reading fast. This game does not let you do that.
No.
They have you press A at the end of every sentence. And this might be either I don't remember 999 clearly or this, it's even worse than I remembered, but Virtue's Last Reward, you'll have frequently instances where your character doesn't actually says anything. It's just like a meaningful silence or an awkward silence or any type of silence, and it's going to have dot, dot, dot. And you have to press A. Dot, dot, dot. And you have to press A again. And it keep doing that over and over again. Just like the whole... You know, very often, just a very short sentence, and then you have to press A. So I just find myself mashing the A button all the time, and I don't like it. Like, I couldn't read faster than that. The dialogue in these short sentences often is, it would not be there, and you wouldn't be missing it, you know? And so, yeah, I kind of think that, A, like, this needed an editor, and B, like, let me read at my fucking pace.
I played this game a long time ago, so I don't recall. Are there settings to adjust anything like text speed and stuff?
From what I remember, the only thing that I could find was like switching maybe like Japanese to English to Japanese and stuff like that. So it wasn't great. Like there wasn't a ton of options. And also there's the thing, the characters, every character that's not the character that you play reads their lines out loud. So there's a ton of voice acting in there, except that the character that you're playing doesn't have an actor reading his lines out loud. So it's just, why would you do that? Why would you make it so that... Well, I understand that there's probably a story reason, but fucking don't give anyone voice actors if you're not going to give the main character a voice actor, because the effect is that it's as if you're reading a book and someone else was reading the same book over your shoulder, reading every other line out loud. It's like, you know,
it's like if you went to the airport and somebody's like playing an audiobook right behind you of the same book you're reading.
But the audiobook's abridged, but not well abridged.
Yeah. So that stuff bugs the hell out of me and added. To that, like the fact that the puzzles are a little bit, you know, kind of find a hidden object kind of thing where you have to explore multiple rooms and I find the controls to look around in each room, cumbersome and move around from room to room. Kind of, it doesn't play great. So all of these little things add up and in the end, I can only find stuff to bitch about. Like, it sucks that, you know, like, the one Nintendo game that I'm talking about is something that really bugs the hell out of me, and that I can't really... I want to enjoy this. I want to enjoy Virtue's Last Reward, but it just... The stuff that... All the stuff that really bugs me personally seems to be in this game. And it doesn't mean that anyone else is going to have the same problems, but... Yeah. Seems to be the type of software that's designed to just, like, irritate the hell out of me.
Anti-Guillaume software.
I mean, this game is definitely, like I said, there are people who really like 999 who will dig it, and people who had issues with 999 but were sort of there, like, okay, I can deal with this, that it'll get on their nerves more. It's definitely wordier. They definitely tried to characterize the characters more, and there's about 5,600 endings in this game versus 999, which had like 7.
Yeah, right. But you got the actual flow chart, so you can do
right.
To what
yeah,
game
you do. And you can jump.
Yeah,
the ability to jump is huge.
Yeah, but that sounds cool. But
yeah, it's definitely in love with its writing more. Hmm. Which if you're not, is a problem. Obviously.
Yeah. No, it's unfortunate. Like just today, I was expressing some thoughts about localization and saying how I really don't care if you localize the hell out of Japanese games if it means getting rid of stilted dialogue or stuff that just editing. I just love when a text is fast and snippy and just yeah. And this is not.
Mm. So Guillaume's okay with all your Doge memes. So he is history's greatest monster.
I am.
Guillaume reads Journey to the West and wonders, God, could they put anything in here about like Doge right now, please? Just something. Just
yeah, sure.
Faster.
And what's up with all the sushi? Please, hamburgers. Come on.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a whole different topic. There are emails in the inbox about that topic explicitly. We will not be getting to them this week.
Kid right. Yin and Dr. Yang.
Oh, God damn it, Greg. That's somehow after this fucking shit show of a recording session, that was my line. I don't know how that was my line, but that was my line. But guess what, John?
Well, you know, Guillaume, his problem was that, you know, the one Nintendo game he talked about was one that he didn't like. My answer to that is just don't talk about Nintendo games, man.
Good point.
So, yeah, I'm just going to give some closing thoughts.
Did you
thoughts
say
to...
I'm just going to give up?
Okay, Greg.
just a little bit of a... This has just turned into a complete snipe fest. It's slowly devolving.
Skype's fault.
Yeah, Freudian slip there, I guess. Yeah, just some closing thoughts on The Witcher 3. So last week, I kind of left off. I was sort of unimpressed by it. It was kind of pedestrian at that point, and, you know, and I discovered that the game starts off pretty slowly. A lot of the stuff you're kind of going through, it sort of sets up, you know, why you're there and what's happened prior and that kind of stuff. And it really doesn't start to pick up until you actually, you know, go through your first sort of adventure, which is going through this cave with this other important character, and that's where you fight your first sort of mini boss, and really start to kind of exercise your combat, and then you come out and you have access to a boat for the first time, which actually really lets you explore the world. So it's kind of like that tried and true RPG thing. It happens early on, though. You know, it kind of varies from RPG to RPG, where you finally get like the airship, and then you can go all over the world and do all kinds of stuff. So it's similar to that. So once you get that, then you can start to kind of roam around the world a little bit, kind of get off the rails. You can get some better armor, which is really good, like getting better armor, better swords, and stuff like that. So you can go through the earlier areas and really start kicking some ass, because up to that point, you're really kind of running for your life, and if you try to take on anything, you'll probably get killed. So you really just have to sort of do what the game kind of, you know, go through the bread, pick up the breadcrumbs that the game leaves for you, because if you try to kind of get off that path, you're going to really get taken out pretty quickly. So, yeah, so, you know, I've gotten to the point now, I think I'm like at level 11, level 12 maybe, I really didn't start to make any progress till about level 5, level 6, so that kind of gives you an idea. But this reminds me, actually, this game reminds me, interestingly enough, of Xenoblade Chronicles X to a certain degree, because it has the same kind of thing where you have a whole bunch of different things that you can do spread out all over the map, and they're little question marks. So even though it's not as explicitly, like, in this hexagon, you have to do this thing, it's kind of the same sort of way where you have, when you come to a new area, and the maps are fairly large, even though there's not a lot of them, there's only, I think, there's probably about 3 big maps and a couple of smaller maps. But when you come to a new area, it's pretty much just a sea of question marks and stuff that you have to investigate. And then also going from place to place, you'll also kind of pick up these sort of in progress kind of quests. You'll come across a bandit camp or something like that you get experience for. So there's a lot of sort of like just kind of spontaneous pickup sort of stuff that can also help you progress your character. So yeah, it's really good. I mean, right now I'm in the biggest city, which is Novigrad, which is incredibly impressive. I mean, it really looks beautiful, and it's a huge city. I mean, it's really impressive in terms of scale, and it really looks like you would think a medieval city would look, a large medieval city. I mean, they really did their homework on how everything looks, and it's really good, and a lot of the NPCs are really interesting, and you know, and what I like about it is the way that the quests are laid out. They're very compact. It really lends itself to, you do a couple quests, you know, you can save anywhere, so you can just save your game, and then of course I'm playing it on PS4, so you can pretty much just hop right back in, and you'll start right where you know, when you bring your console out of rest mode, you'll start right where you left off. So it's really good for that. A lot of times you'll have quest chains that just, they tell an entire story and that's it. So it's kind of convenient. Like, there's nothing, like, you don't feel like you're missing anything. Like, you complete something and you're done with it. So it's kind of really, it really lets you, you know, kind of say, okay, you know, I'm done for the night. It's convenient. You never really feel like you're leaving anything half done. And a lot of the quests are really interesting. They tell really interesting stories. It's almost like there's almost some elements of horror. There's some pretty, pretty creepy parts of the game. The game, again, like I said last week, is very gory. There's a lot of sex, a lot of violence. So
were you just slapping things together when you said a lot of sex?
There is a lot of sex. No, there is literally a lot of sex.
All right.
You have sex with women. So in a graphic fashion. Not too graphic, but Skinamax graphic. Like, yeah.
All right, who's clapping every time John talks about sex? I need to know the answer to this question.
Yeah, it's a response. Yay, sex. So
great.
Yeah. But yeah, and I mean, I've gotten into the crafting somewhat, which is pretty cool. You know, that's one of the rewards for exploring the world, is you'll randomly come across, you know, a chest out in the middle of nowhere, that has, you know, the what amounts to the recipe to make a certain piece of armor or a sword or something like that. So that's kind of your, it's kind of your incentive for going off the beaten path and not just like going from town to town. You know, sometimes if you just head off in the woods, you'll find a cave somewhere and there'll be, you know, monsters in it. You kill the monsters, loot all the chests, and you'll find some crazy stuff that you can then, create when you go to an armorer or a blacksmith or something like that. So yeah, but it is a huge game. It's very much like Xenoblade. It will take you 100-150 hours probably to go through the whole thing. It's big. And I mean, there's other stuff you can do. I mean, you can like kind of go on like special, like kind of monster hunts sort of thing. Like, there's the quests that you can go through, and then there's side quests, and then there's treasure quests, and then there's monster quests. So there's many layers. You never run out of stuff to do. And it just makes me think about
quests.
Yeah. I mean, it just makes me think about the NX, where I really hope that they can just bring games like this to NX so I don't have to go off of Nintendo consoles to play them. I'm really hoping that they're able to do that. That would be very nice. Very nice. Because it's a good game. Very, very good. I would recommend it to anybody who's kind of in the mood for something that's they can really sink their teeth into over a long period of time.
I actually really appreciate the 180 you've done here. It's almost as if an open world game needed to open up for you and deliver.
It did. Well, it's just kind of like, I mean, at the start I was like, all right, cool. It's very medievally, and it's done well. It's obviously, again, it's a well-crafted game, obviously made by professionals, but I didn't get the hook, right? And the hook really is the quests, I think.
Right.
The quests, I mean, everything is written really, really well. I mean, there's a reason why, like at the Dice Awards, this one won the award for best game design. And this game is really, really well designed. There's only a couple of things that I have issues with. The inventory screens, I mean, obviously I mentioned the load screens last week, but that's more of a mechanical thing. But in terms of game design, they could probably do a better job of managing your inventory. Especially the way your inventory works with crafting, because there's just annoying little things like, you, when you're trying to craft a piece of gear, like they have armor sets, kind of like Monster Hunter style armor sets, where if you collect all of the different, you know, things that you need, you know, you can get five different armor, you know, recipes. But the thing is, when you're crafting the armor, there's no way to go back and see what you have equipped. So when you're trying to make all the pieces of the set, you're like, oh, I forgot. Do I have the chest equipped? So you have to get out of that, of the crafting GUI. And then you have to, like, not only that, you have to back out from the vendor. Like, you have to say goodbye to the vendor explicitly. And then you have to go in, check your inventory, see what's equipped. Then you have to go back, talk to the vendor again, go back into his GUI, then go into his crafting GUI. So it's just stuff like
that.
You know
what made that a lot easier?
What, James?
The gamepad.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I agree. So there's just kind of stuff like that where it would be nice to have a better way to manage that inventory. Because, I mean, really, at its heart, it's a PC game. So that stuff is a lot, would be a lot simpler with, you know, a mouse and keyboard. But, you know, it is what it is. It's still.
But even then, you'd sort of dig through all those menus, though.
Oh, yeah.
Faster.
Yep. Yep. So. Oh. Yeah, it's good. It's good. That's I like cool. it. I highly recommend it. Greg, I would say if when you have a spare 150 hours, I would say go to it. but it is very easy to play in the background, though. Like, just like, you know, like you play it for an hour, you know, do a quest, you know, craft a piece of armor, kill a monster, and you're done. You know?
No, if it was one of those games you could play portably and home console, you know, like, you know, if that were part of it, you know, where you could actually play it on the road, but then if you wanted to do something more major, you know, you'd put it up on the big screen. That's the kind of thing I'd like to do with these games. I did that to a, you know, pretty fair extent with Xenoblade Chronicles X, but of course, it's not totally portable. It's just handheld.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty darn good. There's a reason why it won awards. I can say that.
Well, on that, Greg.
Well, yeah. So we've been building it up, and there's no Fire Emblem here, but still, you know, I go into the storm as Bravely Second arrived at home today. So I just had a few
broadcasting straight from the maelstrom.
Yeah, right in there.
As usual, our intrepid forecaster, Greg Leahy.
So I only had a few hours to play it today. Didn't get into it a whole lot, naturally enough. But basically, I got to the part in the first chapter of the game where you link into the AR video that you got at the end of Bravely Default. So that was cool, you know, sort of seeing, you know, that moment actually in sequence, essentially. But other than that, obviously there's not a lot to say beyond, you know, the demo. Although there was an amusing thing, because the day before it arrived, I was listening to the Retronauts episode on Uematsu and his soundtrack work for the Final Fantasy series. And there was quite a sort of a lot made of a particular song in Final Fantasy IV, you know, kind of moment in the cave where that kicks in. And I was playing an early moment in this game, so the first time you venture into dangerous territory, and the song is remarkably similar. It's not Uematsu, you know, this is I forget who this is, sort of Rio or something, I think it's called, the guy who's doing the soundtrack for this, but it seems like somebody either told him or he decided himself that he wanted something that would evoke the same sort of emotions, because it's pretty close. But I suppose that's no bad thing, and obviously this is very, very closely related to Final Fantasy, even if it doesn't bear the name. But yeah,
or a name that's just a reuse of synonyms for both those words.
Yeah, the last story.
I mean, they're gonna run out of those eventually, I gotta think.
Yeah, but
ending tale.
Naturally, I'll be speaking about this in future episodes as I get further into it and see you know, how much it kind of deals with the problems I had with some of the first game and whatnot. But in the meantime, I'm going to talk about Stealth Inc. 2. I got this towards the end of last year because it was... I hesitate to say this because it doesn't make any sense, but it's what comes to mind. Sinfully cheap. Just ridiculous. Like a couple of quid. I almost felt bad for not having bought it sooner. Especially when I actually got round to playing it and rather enjoyed it. So, I think Stealth Inc. 2 featured on, one of Johnny's top five lists. The year it came out, didn't it? Yeah. But Johnny's kind of, yeah, he played, the fluidity games and stuff. He's kind of familiar with Curve digital stuff. I never got around to any of the fluidity games. Well, not yet anyway. They're called Hydra Venture here. That really doesn't have any influence on whether I would have got around to them or not. But, yeah, I've been interested in this. I wasn't really waiting for a price drop, but you know, time passed and there it was. It came up like ridiculous. And we're like, now I've got to get it. And it's great. I've also been playing kind of a number of games in this vein. Like around about Christmas they put Portal Still Alive on discount, and because that's backwards compatible with Xbox One, I just sort of screw it. I've never actually played that. I played Portal 2 and played Portal 1, so I got that. And I played Affordable Space Adventures as well. So I've been playing all these sorts of puzzle games, and this one is interesting because it kind of segues between two different styles. You know, you've got these little challenges that are nested within an overworld. They only ever use one specific power up, one specific game mechanic at a time. And then in the overworld, you'll gradually acquire all these things at once. And even though you can't literally use them simultaneously, you will start to use them in combination to open up more areas of this overworld and continue the game that way. So you've got these kind of parallel progression paths through a somewhat kind of Metroidvania type of game design, which I quite liked, actually. I felt like it kept the challenges that you access where you're using the single power up very focused, but it kept the sort of the overworld bit of it from as being more than just sort of token. It felt like it had its own kind of purpose and progression and all that. And I've unlocked some of the ones like the additional challenges that you don't have to beat just to get to the credits that are kind of interesting in themselves. You're a bit off the beaten track. So yeah, I mean if you haven't got around to this yet, I certainly recommend it. I mean, I think the one thing I would say about it relative to some of these other types of games that are a bit similar, like Affordable Space Adventures, is that with the core challenges, because you're using one thing at a time, it never gets that fiddly. Whereas Affordable Space Adventures is almost about being fiddly. That's kind of the point, isn't it? It's that sort of role play element of it, wherein, you're supposed to be manning all these doodads on the ship, with your friend or two friends even. So that's the thing with Affordable Space Adventures. I appreciate that about it. I think that's kind of central to the nature of the game. I wouldn't advise that it would sort of be changed in that way, that, you get ever more sort of knobs and things to play with on this ship, to solve puzzles. But overall, I think kind of the more focused, streamlined kind of experience is probably what I like the best. Although, I suppose it's interesting to note, in the very end of Affordable Space Adventures, a bit of a spoiler type of thing here, but, it actually starts taking things away from you, which is a bit different. Yeah. But I think it's mostly narrative, isn't it, really? It's to convey the fact that this ship is conking out, basically. It's quite odd that the puzzles actually get kind of simpler in its final stages in order to convey the story of the fact that, you're kind of crawling over the finish line here because you've run it into the ground. Stealthic has some sort of narrative that, basically you've just got somebody trolling you somewhat in the vein of Portal, rather than through a sort of feminine computer voice, it's through the graphics design from Fringe, the TV show. Medium through which he trolls you, this sort of antagonist figure. But the plot isn't really important at all. It's just really nicely designed puzzles. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm still kind of going around unlocking some extra stuff. There's costumes that you can get, which they're hidden sort of analogously to what you might get, like extra missiles or energy tanks in a Metroid game. But they're just costumes for your clone thing. So they don't, I mean, not that the Metroid missiles are necessarily all that important either. It's just fun to find them for the sake of it. But you're certainly not the most powerful incentive to go after them. But nonetheless, really, really enjoyed it. And Like I said, I don't know. Obviously, that offer that I got, it, that was a long time ago. I don't know how long it'll be before it'll be on offer again in the various territories or whatever. But I would say it's worth looking at for probably whatever it's on sale for right now, because I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. I played through maybe the first, I don't know, I played a few hours of it, and I enjoyed it, and then I stopped, and that's kind of, I must have lost, you know, where I was going and stuff, and so it was hard to pick back up. But it's one of those titles that I plan on going back to eventually, because I did like, well, now I'm stuck with Hydro Venture. What's it? Fluidity. yeah, so I enjoyed
those
Fluidity.
Those Brits and their Hydro.
Yeah, and, I tried on the PlayStation 3 the first Stealth Link and did not enjoy it. Stealth Link 2 just had more a better flow to it. I think the kind of the Metroid type of map really adds a lot than it would seem initially.
Yeah, the top stuff.
Well, that will do it for New Business this week. And after the break, it's your Listener Mail. Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview. 7 questions and observations about the Pokemon Sun and Pokemon Moon trailer. Pokemon Sun and Moon have been announced, and an unusual... And the usual rioting in the streets has commenced. Alex Calafi braves the violence and picks apart the trailer in his charmingly obsessive way. Is that a Blastoise riding in a truck trailer? Oh my god! Player characters have full proper sideburns!
Full proper sideburns. Huge.
They're mandatory, right? Mandatory sideburns?
Yep.
Excellent. We also have a review. Mega Man Legacy Collection on 3DS. Don isn't the only Kusuge master at NWR, as Neil throws his hat into the ring to take on this steaming pile of Mega Man filth. Just kidding. He comes away fairly impressed, although unlocking challenges with the amiibo still feels dirty.
Yep.
Coming from Neil, that's saying a lot.
Yeah.
Not that Neil's dirty, just amiibo, plastic figurine stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if Neil's saying that. I'm saying that, though.
Oh, okay. You're putting words in his mouth that he feels dirty?
Of course. What else would I do?
That's true.
All right, and we have a preview of Pokken Tournament for Wii U. Don Koopman puts his greasy palms all over the Pokemans fighter and gives us his thoughts. He examines the various single-player and online modes, or as I like to call them, the stuff that Street Fighter V players can only dream of while Capcom spends their $60 on hookers and blow.
Oh, no.
And we also have a review of Great Detective Pikachu for 3DS by Danny Bivens. Grimdark Pikachu puts on his best man voice and takes to a life of fighting crime. Danny tells us what he thinks of what is assuredly the Dark Souls of Pokemon mystery solving games, and more importantly, instructs us on how to avoid getting hit in the face by a hot dog. Gotta watch for those hot dogs in the face, James.
It's something we all struggle with every day. John, there's something missing from this the script that you've written.
What is that?
A certain little stupid thing you and I did.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, as reluctantly as we can be to speak about this, John and I did a... John, why don't you describe it?
It's a voiceover, a narration, if you will, of a certain game called Lucentec.
Yep.
Yeah, it's an adventure in futility. I would call it that much.
It's called RFN Presents Never Read the YouTube Comments. John and James talk over Lucentec. It's bad. It's a bad trailer or video, and we make it worse.
We do.
Which is always what we're looking to do here. If you want to see someone make it worse, you can go to NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back with your listener mail. Remember, you can send us your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. I didn't get the email address wrong mysteriously this week. That was embarrassing. So, first email. We're just going to get right into it because we want to get in and out of this quick.
Yes.
First email. Brad writes, "Hi, guys. Love the show. I'm thinking about getting a GBA. Do you have advice on must-have games? Perhaps a jumping-off point. Games I've loved in the past include The World Ends With You, Mario 3D Land, Fire Emblem Awakening, Radiant Historia, Mario World Tour Golf, Bravely Default, Majora's Mask, and Xenoblade Chronicles. I've done lots of research online, but perhaps there are some hidden gems along with the well-known titles, Advance Wars, Tony Hawk, etc. Thanks, guys. So I was just thinking, like, do you guys have maybe two games each you wanna call out?
Fire Emblem Sacred Stones would probably be up his alley, right?
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I mean, if you get a physical GBA, Fire Emblem game's not the easiest necessarily to get.
True. As I stare at the copy sitting here on my desk.
Oh, yeah, well, you were sitting on a gold mine, apparently. I assume, you know, if he's researched, you know, the sort of really obvious kind of follow-ons from the games that he's listed,
probably.
He should be familiar with. Obviously, there wasn't really an original Mario on GBA because they were all remakes. There's that. And in terms of the RPG part of it, because there's, you know, quite a prominent RPG presence in the games that he mentions, the portable games that he's mentioned, you've got the sort of drawback of the GBA's life that Square Enix didn't start publishing stuff until 2003. Mm-hmm. Once they sort of managed to achieve an accommodation with Nintendo and Crystal Chronicles and all that business. So, you know, you don't have the same sort of prolific output that you'd get later on from them. But given he mentions Bravely Default, one suggestion I had was the Final Fantasy V GBA version, which was a very late GBA game, well into the DS's life. But I think by then. But, you know, that has the job system and all that. That's very similar to Bravely Default. You know, that's kind of the specific Final Fantasy game that I guess Bravely Default takes the most cues from. So that would seem like a sensible suggestion to me. And then the other one I had is not something that directly leads on from the games that he had listed, but I think it sort of qualifies in the sort of hidden gem category to some extent, although it's quite well known in some circles, is the Astro Boy game that Treasure made
Damn
for
it,
Sega.
Greg.
Yeah,
because it's very, very good.
I've never played that. Always regret
it's
that.
It's very, very good. Got great reviews, but, you know, it's probably, you know, for being a licensed game, hasn't stayed in the memory perhaps as much as some of the other, you know, great games of GBA. There's tons of great games of GBA. We talked about some of them when we had the question about playing it outdoors on the Appalachian Trail or you know, Zero Mission, all that kind of stuff. But I assume he's familiar with all that kind of stuff. But Astro Boy might not be so much, but it's really cool. It's a treasure game. It slows down.
At it and go, oh, this game's going to slow down like crazy.
But and it's got kind of an interesting, almost like new game plus element that ties into the story, and it's challenging, but it's imaginative and fun, and I personally had no kind of familiarity attachment to the Astro Boy license, but it still delivered plenty for me, so I think it's a solid suggestion.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed it, and then I traded it in for peanuts, you know, like an idiot. But I think it's quite a lot worth quite a lot now, so might be tough for Brad to get his hands on it. But back then, like, I remember thinking, like, oh, this is almost like up there with Beautiful Joe. Like, it came around at a little bit later, I think.
Yeah,
it came out a little bit later, but it was in that era.
It was, yeah. For me, it's not so much a game I traded in, but I kind of considered getting didn't, and then it became like gold dust, this Ninja 5-0. And you always hear about that being really cool.
Yeah,
but,
traded that in.
Oh, yes. Really?
I'm an idiot.
Oh.
Wow, so you bought it and traded it in.
I bought it new and traded it in before it was worth anything. Anyway, this is not what the question is about.
Man, this is really becoming about Guillaume's regrets. Let's start at the beginning.
Yeah, on the GBA, I don't remember playing a lot of RPGs. Outside of Golden Sun, and I played that, and I was like, maybe I'm not into RPGs anymore. I don't know. Like, when
sheathe
I think...
your sword.
Alternating opinion. I actually really love those games, in spite of
their
flaws.
I know.
The DS game.
But I was thinking, you know, like Hidden Gem, maybe like imports, because you can play, the GBA was region free, so you might want to grab something like the Rhythm Tengoku.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's great.
That's a great game.
I imported that and it totally can be played, you know, without understanding Japanese. There's a certain amount of sort of, you know, additional kind of color in the game, like going to the barista and all that kind of stuff that's all Japanese text, but just playing the game, you don't need it. It's totally friendly.
Hmm. And I know, again, it's not a question, but when I first got the GBA, I mostly played Game Boy Color games on it. Mm-hmm. And so if Brad hasn't played them, the Oracle of Season, Oracle of Ages, The Legend of Zelda, both are pretty good. And
Pokemon Pinball
definitely
as
worth
well.
Checking out. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, and that's got a GBA version.
Yep.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I mean, if those, yeah, this is probably too on the nose, if we already know about that, but, you know, he talks about Mario Golf, and both the GBC and GBA Mario Golf games are rather good.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, the two games I enjoyed way back from Orbital were Racing Gears Advance and Scourge Hive. Scourge Hive
was
kind of a...
You did go
Yeah,
niche.
That was the one that overlapped GBA and DS, right?
Yep, yeah, it was on GBA and DS, kind of a... Metroid-ish, but an isometric perspective. Pretty cool. Pretty well done. And then Racing Gears Advance. I can't remember that game for the life of me, but it is actually like a good little... I think it's kind of a same thing, sort of an probably made with the same engine. Isometric racing game. Pretty cool stuff. You can like outfit your cars with weapons and rockets and stuff like that. It's really neat. They made a couple of good games and then just basically faded away. I don't even know what happened to them. They went out of business.
Actually, now that you mention like a very, very late GBA era game, that reminds me, Rebel Star Tactical Command. Everyone is going nuts right now for XCOM 2. And Rebel Star was made by, I think, some of the designers of... Julian Gollop, or Jollop, I don't know how to pronounce his name, who previously designed UFO Enemy Unknown. Is that not an XCOM game?
That's like the original, isn't it?
XCOM Enemy
UFO
Unknown?
That's like the original XCOM game, isn't it?
I think so.
Right.
That's like the old like 94 PC game.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It's got a different... XCOM is North America. UFO Enemy Unknown was the European name.
The European name.
So yeah, so you might want to check that out. Like it's got, if you like Fire Emblem, if you like RPGs, like this is... it's freaking XCOM, but without only like the ground combat. You don't have so much the research aspect and the kind of the global defense aspect of it.
Gotcha. So I could go on another tirade about the Mega Man Zero franchise that I've bought 8 transactions worth of stuff. Like, don't need to do that. I could
just
talk about
enough,
Mega Man,
James.
Mega Man Battle Network 2. That's the one to get. It's a really good game, but actually, I want to talk about Klonoa Empire of Dreams, which is a really fun, like, the Klonoa character is fun and goofy and ridiculous, and it's a really good portable kind of just fun Klonoa game, like 2D platformer. It's
much more puzzle based than the PS1 Klonoa that was remade for Wii. I played the first one of those, which has come out on Virtual Console here of Wii U, but you've got the second one, we haven't, so let it not be said that, you know, it occasionally goes the other way.
Consistency. Because I don't do we have the first one?
Yeah, I think you've got both, yeah, but
okay. All right.
The second Klonoa game on GBA has a very odd history, because in Japan it came out soon after the first, but in the West they waited to like 2005 to bring it out. Mm. Very odd. So it
strange.
Might be kind of obscure in that sense, but I think it's quite similar, but I think changes up a few sort of things. Seem to remember something about the bosses or something, but the foundation sort of gameplay is much the same, and it's still really quite good. And there's a Wonder Swan game that kind of started off that branch of the series, actually.
Which makes, them supporting the Wonder Swan, I guess, makes some degree of sense.
Oh, indeed, yes.
And then for my other choice, as you can see, we talked about picking 2 games each. I would say it's not nearly as you know, of a hidden gem, but WarioWare Twisted. We talk about it on the show every so often. It is the best WarioWare game there has ever been.
It's the best GBA game ever made.
That's a hard sell for me, but it's really good.
I think there's a good argument to make. It's as we always say about these sorts of things. it's difficult for me to reconcile. Like, how do I compare WarioWare with Zero Mission with Aria of Sorrow?
Yeah.
Some of those comparisons are easier to make than others, but it's up there. It's really good.
Here's the best argument I'll give you for that. That's never going to come out on the Wii U Virtual Console. Like, it just isn't. Like, you need to play that game with the original hardware.
And I suppose we should mention Drill Dozer. It's the kind of thing that tends to come up a lot in this because it's kind of a late game. It didn't come to Europe at all.
Right level of opaque in terms of its market penetration. Like, people in the know about that game, and they're like, oh man, I've got this game nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah. That's also good to play on the original hardware as well because of the rumble.
Oversized
cartridge.
It's out on Virtual Console now, so it's getting another sort of lease of life of some way. But it's famous for being a Game Freak game that's not Pokemon, which obviously there haven't been too many of. We've had Harmonite and that elephant thing since.
Yep.
Tembo.
Well, if you're looking for an IS game that's not Fire Emblem, Advance Wars and Advance Wars 2 on the GBA.
Oh, yeah, he named it that.
Oh, yeah. My mistake. I apologize.
My bad.
I just read the email. I don't remember it. Fine. Monkey Ball Jr. There.
Well, actually, before, I read, like, IGN's top 25 GBA games and it was number 25. But they also had, like, Super Mario Kart, like, Super Circuit. So the whole list is invalid. But anyway,
what was there?
Calls out tonight, bloody hell!
Right?
Don't get Mario Kart for GBA.
I'm coming for you, Fran Mirabella. All right, next email.
Yes, Nick writes. Hello, gentlemen and John. Under what circumstances should Nintendo be held accountable for taking advantage of the unassuming customer's goodwill? In the wake of the devastation left behind by the tech demo is too good a term for them titles of Mario Tennis Ultra Smash and Animal Crossing Amiibo Festival, the most common refrain I saw online was some variation of, and next production is clearly in full swing and they didn't have time to put out titles this holiday that weren't filler. While this observation is undoubtedly true, the other perspective is almost always overlooked. For example, what about the mom buying her daughter Amiibo Festival as a Christmas gift because she loves New Leaf, but accidentally giving her the lesson of a senseless and merciless universe under the tree instead of the intended worthwhile gaming experience? Think about the broke college kid who doesn't follow the industry but has fond memories of previous Mario Sports titles, so he picks up Ultra Smash to play in his friend's dorm room. Nintendo knows damn well that their core, dedicated audience is savvy enough to check for review scores and impressions before buying a game, which means these hastily patched together pieces of anal sputum are designed specifically to leverage a franchise's goodwill in an attempt to swindle uninformed consumers out of $60. There's a difference between these two offenders and other offshoot games, such as Triforce Heroes, that, while perhaps divisive, still clearly have some degree of craftsmanship and effort put behind them. This is a difference Nintendo assuredly grasps. I refuse to accept they simply didn't know how god-awful these products were shaping up to be during the creation process. Nintendo's brand is built on inclusive and joyous products, thoughtfully constructed by talented and passionate professionals. When games come out that clash so squarely with that ideal, I'm uncomfortable with Nintendo's only backlash being low sales and review scores for the games in question. These are intentionally manipulative and slimy products with virtually nothing worthwhile in them to justify the $60 price point. Hell, I bought Amiibo Festival for $28 solely to complete my Animal Crossing Amiibo collection, and even factoring out the cost of the figures, bringing the price of the disc itself down to $2 plus tax, I still felt ripped off. I intentionally shied away from discussing titles like Twilight Princess HD and Metroid Federation Force, as the jury is still out on those, and even if minimal work has been done to Twilight Princess HD, the core game is still very good. But a definitive verdict of guilt can be cast upon Ultra Smash and Amiibo Festival. The easiest answer is, don't be so emotionally invested in the company's attempt to make money, you dolt. But I'm writing to four men who have been voluntarily discussing Nintendo for free on a weekly basis for many years, so that bridge was already torched long ago.
Bravo,
thanks for taking
sir.
The time to read this. All the best.
It means more than the most times when people say that in this case, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When I had this email, I'm like, all right, I need to cut it down. It's long, but I couldn't find the line that I wanted. I was comfortable removing because it's just, it's like we personally just received Nick's manifesto.
Yeah,
and
this
to
is...
me, the whole thing takes a turn after he just rails on Amiibo Festival when he goes around the fact that he bought it for the Amiibo collection. It's like, oh, and we're back.
Yeah, he's pretty much like nailing this to the wall of Nintendo's offices. But yeah, I mean, Nintendo's, you know, Nintendo, they are not infallible. For the fanboys out there, they do put out some stuff that is bullshit.
I thought you were going to say they're not our friend. And that would be true also.
No, I mean, they're ultimately a faceless corporation.
Yeah.
And they're here to make money and not necessarily, I mean, they try to put out as good products as they can, but they are also victims of the market and the reality of the market that they're playing in. Like, hey, you know, we really should put our money into a system that might make money as opposed to the system that we know won't make money. So, yeah. But hey, at least these games aren't delayed, because a game that shipped too early is bad forever, but, you know, a game that you delay.
Yeah, that's the, well, you know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Nintendo historically
are you done, John McCloud?
Has delayed games, you know, because they don't want them to come out, you know, and damage the brand or whatever. But that, you know, is something that might apply to maybe some of their sort of the biggest series, you know, the ones they hold dearest to their hearts, the ones they think kind of resonate the most strongly with fans. I think, you know, clearly, you know, Mario Tennis and Animal Crossing board game didn't fall into those categories.
No.
You know, I mean, the nature of Mario Tennis is sort of made evident by the fact that, you know, it came out in November or whatever, or early December, you know, in the holiday shopping season in Europe and America, but it only just came out recently in Japan because, of course, you know, it's not the same shopping dynamics there. And it's actually doing okay sales wise there. That's kind of it's clear, you know, that you know, it was strictly to satisfy the needs of the shopping season in Europe and America. You know, and then they just released it later in Japan because it didn't really matter there. But it's not like they've added any content to it or anything like that for virtue of it being later. You know, it's still the same game. And it's got off to a half decent start considering. I can't imagine the baseline is necessarily that great for that sort of you know, branch of the Mario spin-off family tree anyway. But the one thing I would say, you know, I think it's a valid point about you know, that this can damage their brand. I think, you know, it's not something you'd want to do any more frequently than they already do, otherwise I think some real damage could be done. But as I say, I think to some extent it's kind of compartmentalized, or, you know, sort of there's some distance put between it when it is spin-off stuff, even though, you know, it's still, you know, something that they're putting out with that brand on it, so it's going to have some kind of feedback. But at the same time, you know, I mean, Mario Tennis, it's an indictment of Mario Tennis Ultra Smash that I haven't bought it, because I love those games.
Yeah,
know, I play
great games.
I play N64, GameCube, GBA. Obviously, we did the retroactive recently. Got the 3DS one, you know. And so, you know, the fact that I haven't been persuaded to buy it, even though, you know, there's been some decent deals on it, you know, in the weeks hence, you know, is an indictment of what's in that game. However, I don't think it's inconceivable that someone, a casual kind of consumer, could buy it and get some enjoyment out of it, because, I mean, Mario Tennis Open on 3DS had some of the same criticism for being kind of bare bones, and, you know, it turns out the bones could be barer, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I enjoyed that game ultimately just playing matches online against random people, because they play, very differently from each other and very differently from the AI. So you, even though it's not great, it's not what it could be in terms of like, okay, playing, you know, like with friends, with voice chat or that kind of stuff that you might hope for a real package, or has it got a lot of single player content or all that kind of stuff. You know, you've still got, you know, in the case of the dorm room example, you've got local multiplayer there. Covered. You can have two people going online against another two people. Admittedly, again, it'd be better if it had proper matchmaking with friends and stuff, but you know, having done what I did with the 3DS game, I think it's not inconceivable that somebody could get that game and enjoy it, and it wouldn't toxify the Nintendo brand for them thereafter. But at the same time, you know, there will be people that would, having played other games in the series, that would be like, well, you know, my expectations are higher than this. So, you know, it's, obviously they're trying to balance things out. The different considerations they've got at the moment, trying to, you know, maintain a revenue stream on the one hand while diverting their resources, as John said, to, you know, not throw in good money after bad, essentially. You know, they don't want to be doing that. They're doing it to the best of their ability, I suppose. But, you know, it does come with costs.
Yeah. And I was thinking that also the sales being as low as they are, the damage is kind of contained. Like, I wouldn't think that Nintendo's image is really in jeopardy here, because so few people are being affected by the dire, the dismal quality of the Amiibo
Festival. I'd say maybe
it's
a little bit worse in Japan then by that. it's actually shown up in the top 10.
There's a counter argument to that, which is that the highly informed consumers are now like, oh, sure, maybe I need to be a little more careful with what I buy from Nintendo. But
I don't know. I would think the highly informed consumers are like, yup, I know what's going on here.
Let me rephrase that. The mid-level informed consumers who think they're highly informed consumers. what to me, when I look at this, the one thing that I think about, and as an example, I'm going to use a really kind of a field example here. So give me a minute. Street Fighter V.
This is the first thing that came to mind, believe me, when this email was read.
So the line that jumps out at me is talking about, like, basically preying on these poor unsuspecting consumers. That's a big portion of the market, and I don't like calling them that. I'm just going by kind of how, you know, his apocalyptic terminology.
Well, I mean, there's a large part of the market that will buy a game just on name alone.
Right. And what kind of upsets me about the narrative going on around Street Fighter V isn't that the game is feature bearer. I mean, it is feature bearer at this moment in time. It was that this weird, that group I talked about, the thinks they're highly informed consumers, say, well, you should know that the game doesn't have X, Y, and Z in it yet before you buy it. A lot of the market buys games on names. And
absolutely.
You know, I guarantee you there are people who bought, you know, Amiibo Festival and went,
I mean, with Street Fighter, it's like you would assume that it would have what every single other Street Fighter...
An arcade mode.
Yeah, stuff like one-player modes, you know, online that actually worked, you know,
so
things like that.
You do have to be careful with this stuff. If you're a company that is values its brand. I mean, I will give you the counterexample. Sega and Sonic games. Because, like, they put out a lot of Sonic games. And they were bad. And now it's the point where when they make a good Sonic game, we don't believe them.
Yeah, like that's exactly true.
We go like, nah, it's probably just not as bad and our bad detectors are broken or something.
Yep.
So you got to be careful about this stuff. It does matter. You know, when you're a company, if a director makes good movies and then suddenly he just M. Night Shyamalan's over and over and over again. Like, you're going to stop going to see his movies.
Yep.
Even when you hear like, no, this one's good. You'd be like, yeah, but I bet it was actually his dead grandmother all along anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually they lose mind share. And them making something doesn't become an event anymore. It becomes, all right, let me sharpen the daggers.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the biggest outcome of this is just that Nintendo will stop trotting out their graphic of all these great Metacritic ratings that they get. Like,
yeah, it was a rough year. It was a rough year on that basis, wasn't it? Because of some of these things.
Yeah, Devil's Third, and anyway.
God, I wasn't even thinking about that.
I want to see Devil's Third. I look at Devil's Third differently. Devil's Third is a game that should have died that they revived, and I just appreciate it existing. Yeah.
It just shows how dire they are for actual content. Like, in what dire straits they're
in. I think they said, all right, Tomonobu Itagaki can save this, right? And the answer is no, actually, he couldn't.
Yeah.
At some point, they just said,
what James says in general is true in terms of, you know, if people, you know, if it keeps sort of hitting bum notes, you know,
yeah.
people's
it's not,
expectations.
It's not going to happen after two games.
I think it's too small a percent. And also, like, to Guillaume's point, the relative obscurity, I think, of something like a Marriott sports game in general is, you know, it's not going to kind of reach that many people. Yeah, the resonance, the limited resonance that it has kind of limits its ability to create damage. But, you know, I think Nintendo is particularly vulnerable because I think one of the things that's identified with them the most is dependable fun. That you could rely on Nintendo to deliver sort of good, clean fun for all the family, that kind of thing. That is the impression, the sort of surface level impression that a lot of people have of them. So to compromise that really would be a big problem. I don't.
Yeah,
so,
and also they've always crowed about how their games aren't threadbare, right?
Yeah,
like,
you know,
even to the point of, you know, not that they've gone away from this in recent years, but I mean, even to the point where we're like, no, we don't believe in, you know, DLC because we put everything in the box.
We sell you a game that's worth full price.
Yeah.
Already, and then if we put anything on top of that, that's a separate thing. But you know, if we put something in a box, it's supposed to be worth full price, and then you get this kind of stuff. So, no, I think that's absolutely right. This is not something they can get, you know, to the extent that they have got away with it, which, you know, I'm not sure they really did, because I don't know how much sales it really ginned up for them in the end. But, you know, it's not something they could keep getting away with, that's for sure. I don't see this as a kind of repeatable, something that would be repeatable. This is a transition phase we're in, and so naturally, you know, we're going to be coming out on the other end of it, perhaps by the time the next holiday shopping season comes around.
I mean, you could throw things like Happy Home Designer in as well.
It sold over a million in Japan, so I mean that.
Oh yeah, and those Amiibo cards sold like crazy.
So,
to the point where
again,
they were starting events apologizing for not being able to stock them.
Yes, that's true. But I guess that's the double-edged sword part. It says, well, it was more successful, but then arguably could do more damage if it really isn't up to the standards. I wonder if it really would have sold that many if it didn't have some positive word of mouth going for it. It might be limited, but, you know, it probably does, hit a sweet spot for some people. That's the thing. I mean, not everyone's enjoyment of a game conforms to, like, well, it ticks all these boxes and all that, you know, if it just does one thing that they want well, it might end up being worth it for them. That's the other thing.
Yeah, that's like most first-person shooters. Hey, is the online mode good? Yep. Don't care about anything else.
Well, and remember, that game had such a higher buy-in, too. You either had to buy a new 3DS or the stupid little puck. Which, granted, came bundled with it, but that drove the price up. So, I think the important note is, no, two or three games won't do this. I think the other important note is, yeah, Nintendo does have this image of, like, this is good fun for the entire family, Devil's Third 2015, Game of the Year.
Game of the Forever, man?
It certainly is the most...
Forever's a mighty long time in this case.
Most something of something.
It is certainly has the best named protagonist in a Nintendo game in a long time. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
John, next email.
Next email. All right. Maya writes, hi guys, first time emailer, love the show. I had an idea recently about a Nintendo Namco, sorry, Bandai Namco, it's Bamco, God, get it right, crossover involving Mario and Katamari Damacy. I love the Katamari games, but the series seems to have gotten a bit stale recently. So what about a crossover with the Mario universe in which you go around stages based on various Mario games? It seems like it would be a great way to reinvigorate the Katamari franchise and is a game I would love to play. I have two questions. One, I think this is a great idea and would love to have it done by Namco and Nintendo. What is the best way to get my idea to these companies in such a way that it might actually become a reality? I checked Nintendo's website and they have a policy of not reading or accepting unsolicited game ideas. What's up with that? Number two, are there any non-Tendo franchises that could benefit from the inclusion of Nintendo's own characters and franchises? We've seen attempts with sometimes hilarious results in Tekken Tag 2, Mario Dance Mix, Bayonetta, Hyrule Warriors, and others, but I'm curious if you know of any other series where an injection of Nintendo could give it a new lease on life.
So I can answer the first part real quick, just to kind of settle.
It's not just Nintendo.
Right, yeah.
It's anybody,
media
yeah.
Yeah, media companies don't like to do or have these kinds of policies in place because their concern is somebody sends them unsolicited an idea for a game and they're making something similar and then the lawsuits happen.
Yep.
And it's and so if you just have a standing policy of not just we don't accept but we don't read them,
yeah.
Then that sort of says, well no, I mean, we didn't read it. It's in our policy, we didn't read it. Now, at the same time, game creators, the actual people who make games, are people. And a lot of them are on Twitter. And sometimes you could shoot your... And I didn't realize he did this until I was working through editing the emails and realized he's describing Katamari Odomasi. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who originally made the Katamari series. But he's a dude. He's active on Twitter. Of course, he's Japanese, but... Like, you could, if for something like this, you could shoot him like, hey, like, just kind of like as a passing kind of joke. It's just something that makes him think about it. And maybe that's enough. You're not going to be able to get Nintendo and Namco Bandai down in a room. It's like, all right, guys, you guys need to hammer out this negotiation.
Yeah.
This needs to happen. Like, that's not viable, but maybe you can sort of plant the seed in the mind of a creator who can then go on and maybe have conversations at some point in the future.
James is suggesting Inception, basically. That's why I've taken from it.
But let's talk about ideas you guys have, because this is one of the most potentially crazy email, like just setting the table. Like there's a huge wide variety of things available to us. So who wants to go first?
Well, I have a sort of general sort of thing. When he says new lease of life, I think that's the point that I tend to kind of latch on to with this, because, you know, something that comes up a lot, we talk about Konami, we talk about Capcom, we talk about all their old properties just going unused and, you know, so they can't be bothered to do anything with them anymore. You know, if there's any of those that could get sort of reinvigorated by throwing Mario in them and all that, I'd be all for it. You know, if you had a Gradius crossed with Mario, so it was kind of like Paradius, but with Mario characters instead.
Merodius is what you're telling us.
But the point I'm making is that, you know, if you could just bring those back, because they haven't done anything with Gradius for ages now. They haven't done any of the silly spin-offs they used to do for ages there. And it could actually be appropriate for five-year-olds. If Mario's in it, as opposed to you know, when James had us believe that the original games were. Although, I guess, Waluigi in a Vegas showgirl sort of costume crawling around the stage like a sort of robotic crab would be pretty disturbing as well.
Wow. Is the last one five? Is that the last?
Gradius 5 was the last sort of mainline game. There is Rebirth as well, yeah. on WiiWare.
Wow, that is a long time ago.
They did Gradius and Castlevania Contra around 2008, 2009. But yeah, they haven't done anything with the, you know, we talk about Capcom, you know, similarly, you know, Mega Man and stuff. I mean, think about the way Mega Man's in Smash Brothers. You kind of feel like, you know, maybe there's a way to give him another lease of life for that. Because it's happened with other Nintendo stuff, you know, Fire Emblem. You know, it's often right. Sort of credited the fact that those characters were in Melee is credited with the fact that we got Fire Emblems coming to the West shortly after that on GBA. The fact that Ness was in the original Smash Brothers is kind of credited with raising awareness around Earthbound. You know, we probably wouldn't have Earthbound Beginnings on Virtual Console maybe if that hadn't happened. So, you know, Mega Man's in Smash Brothers. Maybe, you know, a kind of Mega Man Nintendo crossover game is like the only way we're going to get anything out of him at this point. You know, because it seems like Nintendo has to kind of come in and like cajole these other Japanese companies to actually kind of play in that space. Otherwise, they've just vacated it.
I like the idea of, so there was that Mega Man versus Street Fighter that came out a while ago.
Oh, where, yeah, yeah.
Or basically, you just played Mega Man and then the bosses were 8-bit demakes of Street Fighter characters in the Mega Man style. I like the idea of that, but he's fighting Mario characters. Because that would be that would be incredibly stupid. And
no, you can have like, you know, like Yoshi eggs as one of the weapon once he kills Yoshi, and then, you know, like fucking Wario's fart cannon or whatever. Like,
oh,
you could do
man,
it.
Yeah, like that's just dumb enough to work. So I was brainstorming ideas about these, about specifically these Japanese companies, because that's where the crossover makes sense. You have things like Hyrule Warriors, which made a boatload of cash. And I was thinking, like, all right, what's two franchises that make no sense together? And I said, aha, Ace Combat and Mario. But then, actually, guess what?
No, that actually makes sense. That's not outlandish at all.
No, John, it already happened.
Yeah.
Ace Combat Assault Horizons Plus has amiibo support, where when you tap amiibo, you get a paint scheme of various Nintendo characters on your jet.
Yep, now, Star Fox and Captain Falcon.
Now, for people who follow that series, this really isn't anything, because their Idol Master series had DLC for Ace Combat 5, 6, whichever it was, 6, that you could go online with your plane painted with the face of one of their Idol Master characters. So, I mean, already that series is just completely off its rocker. So that didn't do it for me. So I was trying to think, what is a good, like, what's a really good hyper Japanese thing? And then I realized, and I think I've even mentioned it on the show before, they need to get that Tecmo Koei train going and have Gust make them an Atelier game starring, I don't know, Waluigi. No, wait, no. Tingle. Tingle. Tingle's Atelier. Atelier Tingle. Done. Like just the idea of just him operating a shop where he makes things magically by collecting parts. Like, but almost any Nintendo character that doesn't get a lot of screen time but is kind of weird. You could do Daisy for all I care. Mm-hmm. Like, just imagine just wandering around these Mushroom Kingdom 3D places and collecting stuff to make other stuff to sell to people. Like, you're all set. So get Gust on the phone. These things basically make themselves anyway. They must, the rate they come out. And there you go. Done. Just have the robot make a Mario-themed one. Hell, you get the Etrian people on. Theirs is a robot, too. It must be.
So, earlier, like last week on Twitter, I was complaining that... I always complain on Twitter, but more specifically...
you and everyone else.
You're really selling it to me.
Xenoblade Chronicles X, long-ass game. I wish I could just explore it and not have to do the grinding and stuff. And I thought, well, what if Nintendo for the NX used the Mira? How's it pronounced again?
I assume it's Mira.
Mira as the world for a Pilot Wings title, you know?
Yeah, like they did it before right with Wii Sports Resort, didn't they?
Woo Island. Right. So just use Mira and, you know, visual showcase right out of the bat. Like, you've already got, like, this really amazing place that you can explore, and you give new life to a franchise that really hasn't gotten a lot of love, Pilot Wings. So just, I don't know. Like, I'm not very creative, so just go ahead and put a Pilot Wings in, like, every freaking giant overworld, you know, open world game that I'm never going to touch. Like, Pilot Wings, Witcher.
Witcher Pilot Wings.
Grand Theft Pilot Wings.
Yeah, sure, yep. Whatever.
Pilot Rim, do it.
Skyrim, yeah.
There you go. All right, John, what do you got?
For my money, I was thinking Mario of the Colossus. In which it's set in the Mushroom Kingdom.
Damn it.
It's set in the Mushroom Kingdom, and you have to
climb a giant Mario.
Yeah, giant Mario, Bowser. I mean, you could go wild with that one. That would be pretty.
I think you already did go wild with it.
Yeah.
And again, this would make the day of all those people with a giant toad fetish.
Yeah.
Oh no!
Yes.
Oh no, not again!
Yeah, I think you would exclude Princess. Princess would have to be the one that you were trying to save, of course. Just for morality's sake, I think.
Why can't I climb giant Daisy? Like, just imagine you're coming up through the canyon and you just hear the rumbling, followed by the deep melodic horror.
That's
crazy. Like, you just see it just arise above the horizon. I think that's actually what you need. I mean, you really did just kill my joke suggestion of, hey, what if they made a Clock Tower game starring Wario?
Like, I've always thought Warrior looks suspiciously like Jennifer Connelly with those eyebrows.
Oh. Harsh, man, harsh.
Like they're like all idiocy aside, and this is a question that is primed for idiotic answers. I mean, just magnificently so.
Although, I say on a serious point, I mean, you know, they've talked about getting more liberal with, you know, putting their stuff out there, you know, for other games, and they got these tighter relationships with Tecmo Koei and Namco Bandai. So, I mean, this stuff is going to happen more. It is.
Yeah.
I said, I really wish it would be, you know, if we could somehow wrangle some sort of Castlevania, you know, if it's essentially Castlevania, but for some reason it's got Barbara the Bat in it, who's just got a Mario Maker costume for some reason, I'm fine with it, as long as gameplay-wise it delivers something that I'm crying out for, you know, it's going to be as stupid as you like.
There's got to be a lot of unemployed former Konami developers who worked on those games if they're not still cleaning health clubs that could be available to make it.
They're not sequestered in their own rooms.
That's right. Finishing the game on their own, not allowed to talk to the rest of the dev team. I make that kind of sad commentary on the state of the industry in Japan, but at the same time, these people still exist. People who made these games.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
They're there for the taking. Mm-hmm. If you own a development studio right now in Japan, I would imagine there is talent available to be had.
Yeah.
And like that would actually it feels like a bad situation. Like you have these companies that can't make their like marquee franchise fighting game, or can't make it as fast as they would like to unless they take a boatload of money for console exclusivity and stuff to push it out in an unfinished state.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you're not a company who's teetering on the brink, if you're a company who is willing to make investments and take risks, there are people to be had and deals to be made to make games and to bring on people who are good at making games to do crazy shit like Shadow of the Mario Colossus.
Mario of the Colossus, man. Trademark it now.
I'm sorry.
Maybe it could be just like The Last Guardian, except instead of that sort of hyena giant dog thing, it's Yoshi.
There you go.
I would feel a much greater emotional connection to the creature if it were a Yoshi.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever. Well, that, like I said, that game might get finished first, so you'd be fine.
Yeah, there's that.
I just like the idea of taking a character and putting it into a gameplay system that works. Like, I think what they did with Hyrule Warriors, I mean, we made jokes about Hyrule Warriors for months because it was so insane. And they introduced a character that was basically like a pop idol. She was basically like Hatsune Miku. Mm-hmm. And like, whatever, just this is happening now. So just deal with it. This character is now part of Zelda lore. But at some point, like, that game just works because it's good. And it was the right mix of, this is stupid, we know this is stupid, you know this is stupid, let's not overdo it, but also not like, let's go completely, like, I don't want to ever find out they're making, like, Animal Crossing cross Neptunia game. I don't want that. that's too far. There's a line somewhere, and I think the closer you get to that line, the better. Like, if you can get right on the line, and just lean over it. That's exactly where you want to be. The minute you step over the line, it's too far.
Well, what if you had Animal Crossing X Tekken?
That's on the line though. That's right
the
line.
We've got the Pokemon tournament coming out now. But the thing is, like, Pokemon and Mario have both been so sort of malleable, haven't they? They've been applied to so many different things, whether it's another company's, you know, project or another company's, you know, game design, or it's
Nobunaga's
just
ambition, something
else. Yeah, exactly.
I've played Mario characters like basketball against the Beastie Boys.
They already did this in the GameCube era to some extent, where, you know, you had the snowboarding, NBA Street. Like, no, I mean, you know, some of these things they've already done so much, there really are no boundaries. The thing about Hyrule Warriors, it was Zelda, so it was a little different, you know. You know, teams do have worked, so you wonder whether they might get a little more adventurous, you know, beyond the sort of the obvious Mario and Pokemon type stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about the two Animal Crossing games from last year is they did want to maybe establish the groundwork for Animal Crossing, because those characters are so incredibly popular in Japan. Mm-hmm. Of making it more malleable so they can start putting them in more things rather than...
Because it has been so narrow up until that point, hasn't it? You know, I mean, it is so similar each game up until that point.
And you can really only do one Animal Crossing per console, because ultimately the goal of that game is to build this sort of long-running, thriving place. So if you're releasing a new one every other year, it sort of flies in the face of what that game is. So giving the ability to use those characters again somewhere else is actually really important, and yeah. You sort of have to establish the ground rules that make that possible. And now you could make friggin' Animal Crossing X Tech if you want.
Well, don't forget they had the Mario Kart crossover with Animal Crossing as well. You know, that's the kind of thing you haven't seen before,
right?
You know, as well.
And Zelda.
You know, and yeah, they put Zelda in that, so they get it. Oh, Smash Brothers has typically been kind of the exception. You know, that's the only place where all rules are kind of suspended and everything can mash together with everything, and it's just crazy. You can have Wii Fit Trainer with Mega Man and Pac Man and Sonic and Lil Mac and all that kind of stuff. But they're opening up, so you know, as much as you can kind of be silly about suggestions and stuff, I mean, it is kind of interesting to see how far they're going to go with it. Now they seem to look at it more as a lever to get more, you know, especially because they've been so hungry for things to publish, you know, because the third party support by itself is so difficult to come by. You know, this is a way that you can get people on board to help you, you know, populate a system with new content. So I would assume that's going to be a significant part of their strategy with NX, while of course they would hope to do better with third parties in general. You know, you have to be prepared for the distinct possibility.
Genne Ibunroku.
Exactly.
Yeah, so John, technically speaking, Animal Crossing X Tekken would be Heihachi and Majima, or Heihachi and Co. farming for fruit in a village.
You would think it would be a fighting game, but actually,
no. That's Tekken X Animal Crossing.
Which part of the Tekken
Crossing?
Street Fighter X Tekken is the Street Fighter game with Tekken characters. Tekken X Street Fighter is the other way around.
Did that actually come out?
I don't think it did. I like the idea of the completely screwed up cast of characters of Tekken just living in Animal Crossing Village.
Well, they're your villagers. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh no, Heihachi left my village.
Oh, so he burned down half of it because he turned into Devil Jin. Great.
Hmm. But isn't there already like kind of fighting game where they turned it into a game where you give them letters and little knickknacks and...
Yeah, it's called Dead or Alive Extreme Beach Volleyball.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
There's your crossover. Congratulations. And that is going to do it for your listener mail this week. All right, I'm sorry.
You okay?
Yep, I'm good. I'm good.
All right.
Dead or Alive crossover. We're fine. You can send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So, Greg, I don't think we have any plugs. So, Greg, what is our end music for this week?
Yeah, so end music is going to coincide with as we recorded this, we've just gone into the Pokemon 20th anniversary. The Pokepalooza awaits us. We've got a Pokemon Direct that we haven't seen yet, and we
have
no idea what's going to be in it at all. When the sun rises tomorrow, it could be anything, honest.
Moon will be up in some other places too, so don't worry about it.
That's true. You've got to consider the time zones, haven't you? So it's the sun. Mm-hmm.
And the tides. Don't forget about the tides either.
But Zup requested us to kind of go back where it all began for the Pokemon series, not just being from Red, Blue, Green or whatever, but actually the music from Pallet Town, where the journey began. So that is how we're going to close out this episode.
Excellent. And on that, we finally end this tumultuous recording session. Gentlemen, thank you for persevering through the noise. Or through the no noise is the problem, actually. Thank you for persevering through the silence. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye. What do we have for plugs this week?
Well, we want to thank Microsoft for their support.
Yeah, we're plugging Skype because it's such a great product.
Yeah, yep. No, I agree. We definitely need to thank Skype for their fantastic use of sabotage in trying to get this Nintendo podcast to your ears. Remember, Skype, just stop.
You have no alternative.
That's right. Thank you.
I'm sure we do, but we're so lazy.
We are so set in our ways, and that is really the lesson of today, I guess. I don't know. I think the lesson of today is Skype will stop you at all costs.
No, it's just not an episode of Inspector Gadget. There'll have to be a lesson at the end of it.
Yes, there does. I'm trying to add new features to the show. Every episode of RFN is its own morality play. There, you happy?
The chapter art for this is going to be a smoker's lung compared to a non-smoker's lung.
All right, we have to end this.